It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Have legal battles over civil rights, the environment, communications, immigration sparked a renewed interest for young people to become attorneys? What's the next generation of legal minds itching to do? We're going to talk about that with Amy Wildermuth, the new dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you for having me.
I said new, and I meant it. This is your first semester as law school dean. You came to Pitt from the University of Utah?
That's correct.
So what enticed you about this position?
Pitt Law is such an outstanding place. I have to say, now that I've been here for 2 months, I sort of feel like it is running so well, I'm not sure how needed I am. And that is a great place to be in. It's a wonderful institution with a long history of producing excellent graduates. We provide, and what we pride ourselves on, is providing a world-class education to our students, as well as the creating and dissemination of really important, impactful work in the law. That's what we do.
Yeah, I want to get into what these young people are interested in when they come all eager as they're starting, you know, that first semester in the School of Law. But a little bit, we need to know a little bit more about you. Do you have a particular area of law that intrigues you?
So I'm known as what is called a proceduralist, which is just about as exciting as it sounds. So I really enjoy thinking about administrative law, the rules around administrative agencies. I really enjoy thinking about the rules in court, not the fun ones, not evidence or criminal procedure. I mean the ones that govern ordinary civil cases. So I really enjoy that kind of work. I also have an interest, a strong interest in environmental and energy policy and law.
Okay. So I believe you were a full-time professor at the University of Utah for, was it about 10 years or so?
A little bit longer than that.
Oh, okay.
But thank you for the compliment. So it was about 15 years that I was at the University of Utah. And then for the past seven, I've been in an administrative role.
I want to ask you how your time at the in teaching law plus that administrative role at the university sort of combined together, that joint experience to put you in position for your new position as dean of the law school at Pitt.
Well, I have a deep affection for the law. One of the things that I said when I took an administrative job at the University of Utah is that, you know, they discouraged me from teaching my courses because, you know, I was really supposed to be a full-time administrator. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, this is not a job I want if I don't get to teach. And so at Utah, I taught three classes a year. And that was sort of my very favorite thing to do. It was the time when I could go and do the thing that brought me to the university. Because sometimes when you're an administrator, you don't always do the best stuff at the university. But getting to teach law to new, eager students was something that you cannot replace. I mean, it's just the best feeling in the world.
Well, unlike an attorney who is supposed to know the answer to a question before they pose it, I will ask this because I don't know it. So I assume you are teaching at Pitt as well?
Yes. It's in this first semester, I asked several times what course I could teach. But they were already full by the time I had selected.
But you're the dean.
I know, right? But I am helping out with the 1L workshops. So that's a required sort of course for our 1Ls. And then in the spring semester, I'm going to teach an old favorite for me, civil procedure, which again, those are rules that people encounter when they're in court on civil cases.
Early in your career, you worked as a law clerk for Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens. Am I right or not that the process with the Supreme Court seems to have become maybe a little bit more open? Maybe we're getting a better understanding, but it still can be a little bit mysterious. And can you sort of pull back the curtain for us? What was that experience for you like?
Well, the first thing I'm going to say here is that it was the best year of my life. And it would be hard to say anything other than that. It's such a special experience. And being selected as a law clerk to a justice, any justice at the Supreme Court, is really winning the lottery. There are so many very, very well-qualified folks out there, you know, to get the opportunity was just amazing. Justice Stevens, very fortunate for me, really felt that his role on the Supreme Court was to select folks from the circuits that he sort of oversaw, because each justice oversees certain circuits. Mm-hmm. And of course, he was from the Midwest. And so lucky for me, I got selected. Very interesting little story. While I was interviewing, I found out that Justice Stevens' grandchildren were going to the high school where my dad was the principal. So I have to tell, I have to say, when I went home, I said to my dad, I sure hope you didn't mess this up for me. And of course, he had not. But that's the kind of small world that, you know, can happen in these situations. I think that there's certainly more visibility. There's certainly a little more known about the Supreme Court because, quite frankly, there have now been websites like the SCOTUS blog that follow the Supreme Court much more closely and have opened it up. The Supreme Court itself has also been a little more open. They finally got electronic filing very recently. Everyone else had. I know they're a little behind, but they did get electronic filing. So it's now much easier to get documents, for example. But the Supreme Court is always going to be a little bit more closed, a little bit more difficult to access, largely because the confidentiality can be upheld in a space that's that small. I mean, we're talking about a very, very, very small operation relative to a lot of other operations in the government. And I think the other thing that they have going for them here are the obligations of lawyers. And so they have been able to maintain that sort of very strict confidentiality around what they do for that reason.
Let's talk about your students.
Okay.
Pitt Law, I believe, is taking in a smaller first-year class this year than about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. The numbers, have they been sort of steady? Are they peaking up a little bit? Are they heading down? What would it be?
Well, I think it's fair to say that in the national market for legal applicants, we've seen a huge drop. And that happened, about the time of the recession. And that's when the legal market itself changed. So we did all law schools experienced a large drop in applications. But that's coming back. We're seeing a lot more interest in law school. And right now, what we're doing at Pitt Law is to really be strategic about what we want to do in our class and really think long and hard about the opportunities that are available for our students. We do not want to be in a position where we are taking more students than what we think the market can manage, right? We want every student at Pitt Law to have the career of their choice, to be able to follow that development path and pursue those opportunities and really have a realistic chance to have that kind of job.
More important than the numbers, who are these young people? What are they driven by?
So we have a little bit older class this year. The average age is 25,
okay.
And that's up a little bit from past. So that means we don't have as many students coming straight through from their undergraduate education. So that means they've gone out and they've had lots of experiences in life.
So a little more life experience.
That's right. They've worked. They've traveled. They have amazing stories. We have a student who actually lived in her car for the last year of her undergraduate education.
Oh, my.
Because she and her family had a sort of split of sorts over religion, and she decided that she was no longer going to adhere to the religious beliefs that they had, and she was forced to live in her car. And then she has been making her way as an independent person since that time. These are the kinds of life experiences, right, that are really impactful and important in those critical discussions that we have around law and policy.
Amy, when you were in law school, the beginning of your career, I mean, was the process a bit different, sort of step by step, put in your time? What about today's students? Eager, impatient, wanting to make a difference immediately?
I think what we've learned is that there is certainly something that students are driven toward that we ought to be doing more of in law school, and that is providing real-life, hands-on experience to our students. We need to do that from a very early phase of their legal education, and I think that's an important change that we have seen in law schools since the sort of, you know, when I went to school or even 10 or 15 years ago. So we now have many clinics that students can get experiences in. And then in every class, we're trying to think about how we can incorporate that experiential learning that we think is so important, that real life hands-on sort of opportunity.
So those clinics are sort of out in the community?
Or? Correct. So our clinics are physically located in the law school building, but we have clients that come in from the community. And of course, our clinic personnel, as well as our students working with the clinics, go out into the community to provide those legal services.
So is that a way to get them that kind of, as you said, hands-on experience, sort of, you know, sort of and keep encouraging that enthusiasm, wanting to do everything immediately while they're still really learning, though.
Yes. And we have other opportunities, right, that get them that kind of experience because we really do want to be a valuable resource for the community. And we want them to understand, right, what it's like to work with real live human beings. And this is really eye opening in an age of tech where people spend a lot of time texting, not as much time calling each other. Those human interactions are very important, those skills that we have to develop in all of our students.
What areas are they interested in? Is there a growing interest in environmental law, civil rights, or what? What have you noticed?
Well, I have to say we were just named by Pre-Law one of the top techs. Law schools, tax schools in the nation, which is a really, really great space to be in. And we have a tax clinic that provides services for low income folks. So this is a real area of emphasis for us. But what I've also seen is that we see more growing interest, as you mentioned, in sort of energy and environmental law. We have historic interests in health law. So we have lots of folks who come to Pitt Law to get joint degrees in public health, perhaps, and get a law degree. And then we have lots of folks who are interested in our global connections and doing work globally.
And so that's another opportunity to learn even more because you have to understand the intricacies of international law.
That's right. And we have 13 brand new LLMs who are in our building right now.
Help us out here.
So an LLM is a student who's already earned a JD or an equivalent degree in their home country. And they come in to take a year of classes here at Pitt Law to learn more about American law. And we integrate them into these classes with our other JD students so they can get more understanding and appreciation for sort of other perspectives of the law from lots of folks that hail from different nations.
In our last 30 seconds, do you have an overall goal for your first year as dean?
I think that it's really important that I spend time listening and learning about a place before we do too many other things, right? So I'm still in that phase of really learning and listening. I will say that I think one of the things that we want to continue to do is to connect with the community in the ways that we talked about. We want to continue to build relationships within the university for interdisciplinary issues and big topics. And we want to continue to support all the people who make our law school community great.
Amy Wildermuth is the new dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Thanks so much, Amy, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Megan Harris, still ahead on The Confluence. U.S. Steel says it's making changes to reduce pollution at its Clairton Coke Works plant. But WESA's Sarah Bowden reports advocates are still skeptical of their good faith effort. Two people were killed this week at an esports event in Florida, and the violence was broadcast on a live streaming service. Next on Marketplace Tech, how streaming companies might respond to capturing violence on tape. And should parents be charged when children find and use their guardians' loaded weapons on others? Existing Pennsylvania law is pretty clear. All that and more when The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
The Byrds' Sweetheart of the Rodeo was the first major album to be referred to as country rock. Those additional four letters helped make country music cool while being a major boon to the career of Gram Parsons, who started and quit the band around this record. At the time, it was contentious among country music fans who didn't want long-haired hippies infiltrating their scene, an issue that the Avett Brothers would face similarly in the bluegrass community some 40 years later. The Byrds released Sweetheart of the Rodeo 50 years ago today. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's the Confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin.
And I'm Megan Harris. Clairton Coke Works says it's cleaning up its act 2 months after the Allegheny County Health Department fined its parent company, U.S. Steel, $1.1 million for creating too much air pollution. 90.5 WESA's health and science reporter Sarah Bowden covered the story, and she joins us now. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Megan. Thanks for having me.
People who live near Clairton have been complaining about pollution for years, but it does employ about 1,100 people. How dangerous does the county suggest the air is nearby and through the Mon River Valley into Pittsburgh?
Well, what we do know is that Allegheny County has some of the worst air quality in the country, and Clairton is one of the biggest polluters in the county. So, and we know that air pollution can cause all sorts of health issues, asthma, heart attack, all sorts of respiratory issues.
Did these changes at Clairton mean that U.S. Steel is acknowledging it needs to do a better job at reducing emissions?
Definitely not. If you read the letter it sent to the health department's air quality program manager this week, the tone comes across as very defiant, saying the recent action by the county was not necessary or appropriate. U.S. Steel says it is making these changes in, quote, a good faith effort, but it still plans to appeal the fine.
So what changes are on the docket then, and when will they be complete?
Yeah, these include updates to the facilities, additional staff, increased training, more monitoring. U.S. Steel says some of this was already in the works before the county issued the penalty in June.
Right. That stems back to a consent agreement U.S. Steel signed with the county in 2016. But if memory serves, health officials weren't too satisfied with that?
Correct. U.S. Steel says what has already been settled will be sufficient in bringing Clairton into compliance, but the county issued this new order and fine in June because it says since 2016, emissions have continued to increase.
So those changes, more staff and facility updates, will that be enough to lower particulate matter and bring Clairton into compliance?
I asked a couple air quality researchers about this there at CMU what they thought, and they told me while U.S. Steel has promised will help, they're not sure it's going to be enough. Environmental activists I spoke to have a pretty cynical perspective on this, citing the fact that U.S. Steel has a history of emissions violations.
And the monitoring. Will U.S. Steel share what they record with the county health department or the public?
I'm still trying to figure that out, but there is an air quality monitor a couple miles near the Clairton plant in Liberty that monitors a number of plants, including Clairton. So if these changes do create improvements, that monitor should pick it up.
Sarah Bowden is our health and science reporter here at 90.5 WESA. Sarah, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Good morning. It's partly cloudy and 70 degrees. Not as warm today with a high of 80 and the chance of an isolated afternoon thunderstorm. I'm Maria Scapoletto with 90.5 WESA News at 9:31. Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro released a scathing grand jury report on child sexual abuse within the Catholic Church 2 weeks ago. Now, he says, state law should make it easier to file lawsuits or criminal charges over years-old abuse. State legislators are expected to take up the reforms next month. Shapiro previously served in the state house and says lobbyists for the church and insurers thwarted earlier reforms, but predicts this time would be different.
People are sick and tired of these institutions getting away with it. And they are certainly sick and tired of having lawmakers defend that status quo.
Shapiro also says since the grand jury report, another 820 people have reported abuse to his office's hotline. Allegheny County Council held its first public hearing last night on a possible civilian police review board. The idea gained traction after the fatal police shooting of Antoine Rose in June. Supporters say a board could increase oversight of the more than 100 municipal forces in Allegheny County. County councilors heard testimony last night about various forms a board could take. It could advise on department-wide policies, for example, or investigate alleged police misconduct. All state prisons remain on lockdown today following reports over the past few weeks that 29 staff members have been sickened by unknown substances at 13 facilities. The Pennsylvania Department of Corrections announced yesterday it's suspending all visits and requiring all employees to wear gloves. The department also notes that 20 corrections officers at an Ohio prison were reported to have experienced possible opioid overdose symptoms yesterday. Allegheny Health Network's parent company, Highmark, is launching a pilot program to reimburse emergency services even when patients aren't brought to the hospital. 90.5 WESA's Kathleen Davis reports.
Bob Wanovich of Highmark says EMS companies aren't always reimbursed for patient care that happens outside of a hospital. That's because most insurance companies don't cover this care, and sometimes the patient doesn't pay. Wanovich says Highmark will now make sure EMS is reimbursed when treating things like asthma attacks and low blood sugar.
If there's a real medical need and the EMS responds and they provide treatment to a Highmark member, we're saying, look, we're going to step up and pay for that as part of your coverage. That's good for the member, that's good for EMS.
Wanovich says Highmark will track if emergency room traffic decreases. He says that could speed up response time for more urgent cases. A bill that would require this kind of reimbursement passed the State House last year and is awaiting action in Senate committee. Kathleen Davis, 90.5 WESA News.
For 90.5 WESA News, I'm Maria Scapoletto.
Free to present the facts.
Free to explore.
Free to pursue the truth.
90.5 WESA, Pittsburgh's NPR news station.
The sound of a free press.
It's the confluence where the news comes together. Tear gas. What comes to mind? Photos of riots, clouds engulfing protesters. You're probably not imagining the rolling farmlands of Mercer County, just 90 miles north of Pittsburgh. But that's exactly where reporter Jen Kinney went to learn about Combined Systems Incorporated, a manufacturing plant for non-lethal weapons.
For more than 20 years, Terry Burns has lived on a small country road here in Jamestown, Pennsylvania, population 617. She sells vegetables and lawn ornaments out of her home. But just a half mile behind us, on the other side of a stand of trees, is a munitions plant. Combined Systems, Inc. manufactures and tests non-lethal weapons, tear gas, smoke bombs, crowd control devices.
When we got tear gas, one time was really bad. They came and they wanted to evacuate the area. It was a cloud, smoke coming our way. You could tell it was something so unusual. It's something dangerous, if that's what you want to say. I didn't know what to do.
According to federal safety records and newspaper accounts, accidental tear gas releases like that one are rare. But test explosions can be heard coming from the plant multiple times a day. Non-lethal weapons are a $1.6 billion a year business. And CSI, which is owned by the Carlyle Group, is one of the world's leading manufacturers. Tear gas is a chemical weapon. The 1993 Chemical Weapons Convention bans its use in wartime. But countries still deploy it in domestic uprisings and unrest, and its use is on the rise, as seen recently in Egypt, in Turkey, in Gaza, in Ferguson, Missouri. CSI set up shop in Jamestown in 1995. They didn't respond to requests for an interview, but one reason they might have ended up here is that there's no zoning in this unincorporated part of town. Some neighbors aren't happy to have them here. They complain of the explosions and the occasional fire, but most people I spoke to were glad to have the plant in town.
My name is Mike Rowley. I'm borough council president for Jamestown, PA. We used to have a lumber yard, two lumber yards at one time. There was probably 10 gas stations, two railroad stations in town, tracks going north and south, east and west. All that is gone. So now we have what we have, and there's not much here.
Today, what keeps Jamestown running is tourism to the lake. The town is right next to Pymatuning State Park, one of the most visited parks in the state. There's a mill that makes paint, and then there's CSI, which employs around 230 people.
Something like that was pretty much a godsend for a lot of people. There just isn't, in this immediate area, there's just not the work that there used to be.
But everyone I talked to also agreed those jobs have their downsides. The website Indeed, which allows employees to anonymously post about working conditions, has plenty of posts like this one. A good place to work if you want to get underpaid and deathly ill. Audie Davis says he worked just one day at CSI, measuring out different chemicals.
It irritates your eyes, your nose, and you come home and you couldn't get rid of the smell for, you know, a few hours.
Davis says he wasn't offered a mask or a respirator, and he found it difficult to breathe. He quit after a day. At less than $10 an hour, it just didn't seem worth it. Low wages came up in every conversation that I had, but there's not a lot of opportunity here.
This area has need of a lot of work. We'll take anything that comes in just to make people employed.
The group Physicians for Human Rights, which shared the 1997 Nobel Peace Prize, wants tear gas's non-lethal classification reconsidered. It has been linked to deaths and serious injuries in Palestine and elsewhere. And CSI, according to multiple media reports, they supply the Israeli Defense Force. Canisters recovered in Gaza, Egypt, and elsewhere bear CSI's brand name, its address in Jamestown, and the words "Made in the USA."
There's a lot of times when they say, like in Israel, when they use their non-lethal bullets and their rubber bullets and their gas and that, so most of the time it comes from here. Oh, yeah, and most of the people say, yep, we manufactured that. We put that together. We sent it. There's a little bit of pride involved in that.
Still, neighbors like Terry Burns find that they're always looking over their shoulder, worried at the sound of a helicopter hovering over the plant.
I wish it wasn't in our backyard. I wish it was in somebody else's backyard.
But as long as the global tear gas trade continues to boom, Jamestown is guaranteed jobs and test explosions and the occasional accident for some time to come. For WESA, I'm Jen Kinney.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.